Thank you, Bonnie. My name is Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Bonnie for calling me and thank John for, I can't imagine what John would have thought of me. There are way better people in Tulsa to speak, but I'm grateful to be here. The food was wonderful. The desserts were just, whoa, I mean, it was all so great. Thank you for my corsage. And I get a turkey. I'm telling you, we're just set. We can go home now. Let's go. But I am grateful to be here tonight. I'm grateful to be sober. My sobriety date is May the 9th, 1982. And I can't even begin to believe that. Because I know that it's God's grace that I'm sober today. Really, nothing much that I have done. And I don't know why the miracle happened to me, but I am totally and completely grateful. I didn't know, Joe, that groups had gotten away from studying the Big Book back then, because the group that I joined when I first got sober was the primary purpose group that met at 5th and Yale. And we had a Big Book study and a 12 and 12 study and a beginner's meeting every Monday night. It was a two-hour meeting. But I know that I went to visit Nashville, Tennessee a few years after I was sober, and certainly after being in many, many, many Big Book studies, 12 and 12 and beginner's meeting. And, you know, in Nashville, Tennessee in about 1986, there were no book studies. No, I mean, I came in the meeting carrying all my books, and they go, oh, we have, there's a book. People in meetings didn't know there was a Big Book. And so I didn't stay in Nashville very long, but we are really blessed here to have some wonderful AA meetings, and I too kind of feel that same way about discussion meetings. I used to go to what I called my little old ladies group that met at noon, and I won't say where that meeting was, but it was a discussion meeting every day, and it would just bog down about somebody else's something going on that had nothing to do, you know, about personal problems, family, you know, somebody else being in trouble or something, and it really didn't have anything about, it really veered from the main purpose of what I believe Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. And I'm grateful for all the other 12-step programs, because I've made use of most of them. But I do believe in the singleness of purpose that I have one friend, Mary, and she says, I just think we should combine all the meetings. And I said, what? And she said, yep, OA, AA, VA, GA, NA, CA. And I'm just going, I just don't see how that could possibly work. And I really don't. I believe that our singleness of purpose and to keep the message from getting watered down, you know. And I'm grateful. I mean, if we look in our Sunday paper, there's over, gosh, I don't know. I mean, just look at how many support groups there are for every different kind of dysfunction or need for support, and that's fine. And it may not be a dysfunction. I don't mean that, but I'm talking about me, my dysfunctions. But I still, I don't think you all have any other than just the alcoholism. I'm sure of it. I know that nobody here tonight ate too much. Did anybody here eat too much? But anyway, so I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, born in 1950, and that, boy, I tell you, the end of the month, I turned the big 5-0. So, I can't believe it. I know, it's hard to believe, but didn't think I'd live this long, actually, and the way I was going, I wouldn't have made it had it not been for this beautiful program. But I grew up in 1950, and I had a good public school education there, and I believe that my teachers taught me the difference between right and wrong, and my folks did the best they could. I always had a sense that I wanted to please everybody. I went to school. I absolutely loved school. Boy, first grade, my mother dropped me off, and I was just in heaven. Loved my first grade teacher, was the sweetest woman. Her name was Mrs. Rice. She had just gotten married, and she was just so sweet. And my second grade teacher, Mrs. Lavender, was still my very favorite teacher of all time. She let us do the the Hokey Pokey and the Bunny Hop in class every day, and I just loved it. But I just love Miss Lavender. She's so great. But anyway, I was raised up in a time that I certainly knew the difference between right and wrong. My mom's side of the family was just riddled with alcoholism. My grandfather was just a fallen down drunk. My mother's brother, my uncle, was a fallen down drunk, and they lived together. They lived with my grandmother. And every time they would go on a big bender, my grandmother would call my mom to come rescue her, saying, "They're going to kill me. They're going to kill me. You got to come help me." And so my mom would load me in the car and drive over to my grandmother's house, which would take us about 25, 30 minutes to get there. And usually by the time we arrived at my grandmother's home, my grandfather and my uncle had already passed out. You know, the crisis was sort of over, and they were drunk enough that they were just passed out. And my grandmother's house was like a duplex, and my uncle and my grandfather, they were at the back of the house. There was an entrance for them, there's separate living quarters and everything. And but I can remember that the three of us, my grandmother, my mother, and me, we would just kind of all just kind of go in and just look at them, you know, just passed out there. And I can remember the smell in that room, because obviously they'd been sweating a lot, and the smell of alcohol and sweat and urine. One day, 22 years ago, you know, I woke up and I was smelling that smell again that I had smelled when I was 5 or 6 years old. It was me. It was my house. I was going, "Oh, God, what's happened to me?" But when I was about 5 or 6 years old, whenever I made a conscious thought that if you drink whiskey, this is what happens to you, I saw what it did to my grandfather and my uncle, and also what it did to my grandmother. My grandmother, bless her heart, was an untreated Al-Anon and just beside herself most of the time. And also, she was a very religious person, and I also saw that her religion did not do her any good at all, from my viewpoint, you know. She would pray that my grandfather and my uncle would be sober, and, you know, all her prayers didn't seem to work to get them sober. And she suffered a great deal, but I think that I also got a kind of a negative idea of what God was about, or certainly when I went to those Sunday school classes, I sort of turned, you know, I said, if this is what God is, I just don't want to have any part in that particular God. Thank you so much. So at a very early age, I kind of turned my back on that idea of God, because no one in my family, and especially the most religious people in my family, never seemed to be very happy at all. So anyway, I grew up and did well in school. I really did like school. I liked most of my teachers all the time, and I was a little people pleaser from the word go. Loved, you know, sitting right up in front. You know, I'd rush to get the first seat in class every school year, and part of that was because I couldn't see the blackboard because I was going blind, but all the teachers thought that was because I was really interested, but I really was. I really liked school, and it took me out of my home. My mom and dad fought a great deal. I was like the guy in the big book. I think his name is Jim, and they said he's a pretty nice fellow, except he has this nervous disposition. And I grew up with this very nervous disposition. I had migraine headaches. I got along fine with my mother when it was just the two of us. When Dad came home, it was just, you know, they just didn't like each other. They did not, you know, they didn't get along, and that hurt me, because I think all that a kid wants is for the parents to love each other and to get along, and they didn't like each other, and they showed it. But I also, there was some understanding there that I would be taken care of. I mean, my life wasn't in danger. They weren't violent. They did not drink. So I'm certainly grateful for that, because they fought bad enough being sober. But when I was about 14 years old, that Christmas, my mom and dad bought me a guitar. And I've been singing my whole life. Mother stuck me on TV when I was 4 years old, and I seemed to have a big, loud voice. And, you know, it was about 1964, 65. The Beatles had just hit. Mom and Dad buy me a guitar. Lo and behold, I can play it. You know, I take a few lessons. I learn how to play. I join an all-girl band. They started paying us money right away in these little places where we would go play. And as soon as anybody gave me any money at all to sing, I was like, that's it. I'm gone. So we put this band together. We went out to Hollywood, got a Hollywood agent, and went on the road. And I knew pretty much from then on that that's what I wanted to do. But I'd made that decision at 5 or 6 years old that I'm not going to touch alcohol. It had ruined my grandmother's life, my grandfather's life, my uncle's life, and I'm just not going to fool with it. I'd made that decision. And so we're playing around in all these bars, and it's interesting. We're all underage, and we had to do big legal things to even get to work in nightclubs. But we'd kind of sign papers, and we'd have to have a guardian with us at all times. And while I was in that band, which was about 3.5 years, I never took a drink. I mean, I was underage, but I was underage anyway when I started drinking. But it's legal. Okay. So anyway, I got out of that band, and I joined a band. And there was a guy in this band who had really been wanting me to marry him for a long, ever since he saw me in this girl band. He said, you're just going to be my wife one day. And so the power of a guitar is a powerful thing. So anyway, I joined this band, and we moved, you know, I was still kind of in California, but I knew I wanted to stay in California. And so I joined this other band, got rid of the girl band because we were just getting too old, and we'd also made a pact that none of us, we were not going to date because we knew that that would not be good for the band, and we were going to, you know, I was the only one actually who stuck to that. All the other girls were sneaking out, and I was a little naive Debbie, didn't know. So anyway, I joined this band. It was in 1968, and we were in California, and then anyway, in 1969, I married my first husband, and the winter, I am getting to my first drink, this is it. I'd stayed away from alcohol, been in bars now for about 4.5 years, had not touched any liquor at all, oh no, and so I went, we were going to go meet his parents. We got married in the summer, but we'd not let any of the parents come to the wedding because, well, it was 1969 in California, if you know what I mean. So we did not want our parents hanging around. And so we were going to go. His folks lived in Davidson, Oklahoma, way out in the western part of Oklahoma, down in the corner near Vernon, Texas, if that helps anybody, out by Frederick, Oklahoma. And they lived on a farm. And so I'm going to go meet my new father-in-law and stepmother-in-law. And we get to their house. And it's Christmas time. And it snows. And we're pulling a trailer. And we've got a big van. And we've got all the equipment with us. And they live kind of pretty far off the highway at this farmhouse. And it snows. And we were only going to stay 2 days. But we end up staying about 4 or 5 days. So we walk into this farmhouse. I guess I'd never been in a farmhouse. There were guns along every wall. I mean, just like wallpaper. And then below the walls were these buffets. It was kind of a shotgun, long house, big house, long, big house. Buffets, like that ultra thing there. But imagine that with like 40 bottles of gallon things of Jack Daniels on it. I never saw so much liquor in a nightclub, but I've never seen anything like that in a home. And all these little decanters with little, you know, thousands of little shot glasses. I mean, these folks drank and played with guns. And these are my new in-laws. And so, and up to that point, I think I had just turned 19. And it was getting dark, you know, early in the day. It was getting dark around 4:30 or 5, and they would start drinking, and they encouraged me to drink with them. And for the first two nights, I said, no, I don't drink. Thank you very much. No, thank you. Uh-uh. So what happened that first night, though, is that they started drinking early in the afternoon or evening, and, you know, a couple of hours of that, then they were fighting with each other. And she carried a pistol in her purse, and then there's all these other guns, and they get mad at, you know, they're having a fight. And I'm, keep in mind, I'm Debbie with this nervous disposition. And I'm going, oh, God, somebody's going to get killed. And so we wake up the next day, right, just like an alcoholic. Everybody's acting like nothing happened the night before, that everything is fine. She's making this huge breakfast. I don't know. They go out and slaughter a cow and bring it in and put it on the flame. And, you know, we're in the country here. And, but I'm just, you know, my eyes are real big, and I'm going, just get me out of here. And it snowed. We can't leave. We can't get the trucks out. We can't get out. And so I have no idea what I'm saying to my husband at this point, except we got to go. We got to go. But the second night, you know, the same thing happened. They started drinking. They get in a fight, talking about people killing each other. I get really nervous. So I don't know if it was the second night or the third night that I, they kind of pushed a drink my way, and I took it. You know, it was a straight, and they just drank straight shots and chased with little Coca-Colas. So I said, sure, and I took a drink of that Jack Daniels or whatever whiskey it was. I think it was Jack Daniels. And, you know, within a minute or two, I mean, I'm sure I coughed and gagged and, oh, how do you do that, you know? And then the magic happened. I mean, the mystery to me is why everybody that drinks is not an alcoholic, because the magic happened to me. I started feeling warm and soft and beautiful and loving and kind. And all those promises, you know, that are in the big book, that if we work the step, you know, fear of economic insecurity, it left me. Fear of them killing each other left me. I just didn't care. That'd be fine. Can I have another drink? And so it really did. I was instantly addicted to alcohol. I mean, I did not ease into it. That night, I drank all that I could. I passed out, or at first I blacked out, and you know, I found that out later the next day. But I blacked out, then I passed out. I woke up the next morning with the vow that I would never do that again. That was crazy. I knew that to feel that awful, to ingest stuff that made me feel so awful, that was truly a crazy, insane thing to do. And I swore off that day in 1969, you know, and I didn't sober up until 82, so, but I was on my way, and I got drunk the next night, and the next night, I was drunk every day until we left, and then I was drunk pretty much every day until 1982, so, there was no part of me that I don't know anything about any kind of social drinking. Now, I understand that there are women who drink many years socially, and then at some point they, or maybe guys do too, but I was just instantly addicted to alcohol. I loved everything about it. I loved the way it made me feel. I loved the way it made me not feel, because I would begin to do things that I was embarrassed about from the beginning. You know, the guys in the band thought I was kind of cute and funny, going, oh, Debbie, you're so funny when you're drinking. And I mean, I remember hearing that. So I'm sure that's what I heard instead of, at some point, I'm sure it had to be, Debbie, you were so disgusting when you drank. But I didn't hear that. And so I was in that band for, you know, a few years, from 69, and I think I moved to Tulsa in March of 1974. I was looking for the geographic cure. I knew that I had to leave Southern California. I was pretty convinced that if I just left California, all my problems would be solved. And my dad is still convinced that alcoholism begins in California. California causes alcoholism. Even though I had that first drink in Oklahoma. But, well, by God, it's California. You never should have gone out there. But yeah, Daddy. Okay. And so anyway, I moved to Tulsa. I'd met some musicians in my many years of being on the road. I met a lot of great musicians here in town. There are some great musicians here, no doubt about that. So I came here for the musical community, and I came and I told everybody that I had stopped drinking. and just set myself up big time. And I would carry little little half pints in my purse, or, and when I didn't have a half pint, I would put when I was really trying to stop drinking, I would only drink scotch because I really didn't like the taste of it. Excuse me. So I would I'd pour like fruit jars, you know, I'd put a jar in my purse because that wasn't really like drinking; it was just a jar. It wasn't a liquor bottle, it was a jar, for God's sake. So, and I would try to hide my drinking, but then, you know, because I was just so, once I had, talk about the doctor's opinion, once I take that first drink and the phenomenon of craving develops, I was just gone. And so there was no hiding it, and, but I really made an honest attempt in 1974 to stop drinking. I knew it was, and I'd been drinking at that point about 5 years, I knew it was a really serious problem, and that I needed to do something about it. I just didn't know what that was. So I continued on like that for a long time, and my recollection is sort of sketchy. But in maybe 1979, I picked up the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and someone at the office sent over Sherry A. and Joni F. to come and talk to me. And Sherry was just about my age, and Joni was older, but I was really impressed with both of them. I was living in a little duplex that hadn't been cleaned and since we moved in, you know. And so I tried to wrestle around and try to get the duplex kind of cleaned up a little bit before they came over. And they just came and talked to me in the afternoon. And then Joni, I don't remember anything they said, but I know that they were nice to me, and that I had the sense that they really did know what they were talking about, although I don't, you know, I just had a sense that they were not blaming me. It wasn't like they weren't religious fanatics, which I was kind of afraid of that they might be. And so Joni said that she and her husband would come by and pick me up, and they were going to take me to an AA meeting that night, and they did come by and take me to the meeting. And I was just absolutely horrified and so nervous I just couldn't see straight. They took me to the fellowship group that used to meet out at the bypass out off Skelly Drive. And I just remember the lights were really bright. They were studying off like some recipe cards. And I just thought, oh my God, what am I doing here? And so I don't remember anything except the lights were bright, don't know what they were talking about, and just couldn't wait to leave. And then Joni and her husband Chuck took me back to the house. And then I don't know what, I think that obviously the seed was planted, but not very deeply. And but I kept thinking I can figure my way out of this. I can figure my way out of it. And but I think somewhere in my heart I knew that they were probably right. So over the next couple of years, I would go to an AA meeting and hate every moment of it and just kind of look for the differences and going, I really, God, I don't want to be here. And but I did keep going back. And I had a friend, another musician friend by the name of David T. And David would call me and go, Debbie, let's go to that noontime meeting. And that was a meeting that used to meet at 36th and Yale, which was like 3 blocks from my house, but I thought that was too much trouble. And so David would call and go, Debbie, let's go to the meeting. I go, David, I can't. I just can't. And he says, I'll be there in 15 minutes. Just throw something on. And so David came and took me to many of those very first meetings. And we weren't staying very sober, the two of us, but I really I'm so grateful to David for getting me to some of my more meetings that I would have gone to on my own. And I just kept coming back. You know, I would go and I'd drink, just like the book says, try some controlled drinking. Man, I was trying as hard as I could to control it. I was really trying hard. And I just kept coming back. And I started going to a women's group that met at the outpatient clinic over at St. John's on Monday night. And I met some really, really great women over there. And I was singing one night up in Bartlesville at the Moose Lodge. Now I'm getting to my last drink, or what I hope is my last drink. I've tried for a long time to stop, and I just couldn't. So, and of course, when I was coming to AA, I wasn't doing 90 meetings in 90 days. That just seemed like a little excessive. And I wasn't getting a sponsor. I didn't want to talk to anybody, and I wasn't going to work any steps. So, but one Saturday night, I was up in Bartlesville, and I, you know, I've maybe been about 2 to 3 weeks without drinking anything. And that night I had this terrific migraine headache, and I thought, well, I'm just going to have a scotch and water. Maybe they'd take the edge off and take some Excedrin or whatever. And so I had that drink, and my headache got worse. And then I took a couple of muscle relaxants that I'd gotten from my doctor, and I thought that was okay. And so I took those, and my headache got worse. And then I did a couple of other things that should have helped me, and they didn't. But that night, which was May the 8th, 1982, you know, I just had a couple of this and a couple of that and a couple of this, and I was as aware and awake and alive as I am tonight with the awareness of, Debbie, this no longer works. This just is not working. And if I could just get back to Tulsa, I would call this girl, Sherilyn, and ask her to be my sponsor, and I would do the 90 meetings in 90 days. I would work the steps. I was willing to do anything. And I for some reason, I didn't get loaded that night. I mean, it was like I couldn't do enough to get loaded, and I knew it wasn't working. But to me, that was my first spiritual experience. Even in a mood-altered state, I knew it was no longer working. So, we spent the night, we went on up to Independence, Kansas that night, and then early the next morning we came back to Tulsa, and I called Sherilyn, and Sherilyn was about just a little over 2 years sober at the time, and so I called her and I said, would you be my sponsor? And she just acted like, oh no, I couldn't possibly be, and because she was afraid she didn't have enough sobriety, because she had two sponsors, and both of them had long-term sobriety. So she said, well, let me call my sponsors and I'll ask them. So she called me back a little while later and she said, yeah, I can be your sponsor and anything that I don't know, I can't remember her sponsor's name, but, you know, she was saying they'll be able to help us. They'll be able to help us. And so, and that next Monday night, the primary purpose group was beginning. It was like the very first meeting, or maybe the second meeting, but it was very early in the formation of the primary purpose group. And so I made that my home group every Monday and Friday night, and I was going to noon meetings every day. I was going to two meetings a day for about a year and a half. And I just, once I surrendered, once I knew that I knew that I knew that I could not fix myself without God's help and without the help of you people in AA, it was easy. I mean, I was on a pink cloud for, I don't know, about 5 years. Just, you know, life was, when I got my 90-day chip, it was tremendous. Just getting the 90-day chip was like, there had been lots of days where I had not thought about drinking, lots of days that were good. I began to sleep better. I was really, really, really happy. I was just content. Mike was the greeter at Primary Purpose every Monday night, every Friday night, and it was a joy. And what a blessing you were to that group, Mike. And all those special people, Ben and Gloria and Mason and Mary. And early sobriety is just... I mean, I don't want to go relive early sobriety, but all the connections that we make when we first get sober are just so important, and I have beautiful, fond memories of that group, and we would, there were about five or six of us girls who would get together every Monday at about 5:30, and we'd all go have dinner, and then the meeting was 7:30 to 9:30, so we'd do the meeting from 7:30 to 9:30, and then my sponsor and I would sit in her little Corvette out in the parking lot, or no, it wasn't a Corvette, it was a Chevette. Big difference. Wait a minute. shove it. What she called it, a champagne color. I said, Sherilyn, it's brown. But, you know, she'd be smoking like a fiend in the car, and we'd be in the middle of winter like now, and we'd have the windows rolled up. I never remember the smoke bothering me at all in my first 5 or 6 years of sobriety. Now I cannot bear it. But back then, it didn't bother me at all, and I cleaned out ashtrays and just thought it was great. But it was just learning how to work the steps, and my life was really transformed very quickly. I'm sure every day everything was a very big deal, and I called Sherilyn 4 or 5 times a day. She had a job that, you know, she was allowed to get phone calls. I mean, she was a receptionist, so, you know, she could intercept my phone calls. And bless her heart, she would talk to me, and I know that it was, being self-centered as I am, that every little thing seemed like a big deal. And she just always gave me wonderful advice of what I might do and what step I might be on, or, you know, or just going, Debbie, what step are you on? Ooh, that fear step. I'm on that fear step. So I just, it has, you know, I've been sober 18 and a half years, and I can't claim any of that for me. I'm grateful for it. And I met with some women today that I dearly love, and we were, one of the women sort of said in passing, I wonder why some of us get sober and some don't. You know, David never was able to get very sober. He was never able to rack up very much time in sobriety, and yet David was a wonderful messenger for me, and to come and pick me up and to take me to meetings. And I don't know why, and sometimes the why questions just can't be answered or won't be answered until later. But I know that those of us who are sober and experience this incredible way of life, we have an important function to carry the message. And I don't always do that very well, but I am grateful for those who continue to carry the message to me in these meetings. I don't always work the steps. I'm not as conscientious as I was in the beginning about what, you know, if you ask me what step am I on today, I just wouldn't even be able to tell you. I hope maybe by now that I've integrated the steps into my life so that it's just, it's an innate part of my life that drinking used to be. Because when I thought about not drinking, drinking was such a part of my life, I could not imagine a life without not drinking, because it was such a part of who I was. So I'm hoping that long-term sobriety means that we begin to live the steps on a daily basis and not consciously think about it. But because there, I know that when I was in my first year of sobriety, I would have drunk dreams. Any of you have drunk dreams, you know, where you dream that somehow you had a drink and that you were going to have to go to your group and change your sobriety date? Anybody have that? I used to have dreams that I got drunk, and then I knew I was making progress, though, when my dreams of me getting drunk, that I would have to go and change my sobriety date. You know, I mean, I was consciously in my dreams thinking about changing my sobriety date. I don't know what that means, but but I thought it's taking hold, you know, and it's taking hold inside at a cellular level. So I just, you know, my husband and I are both in the program, and I am grateful for the love that we share with each other and to be able to share the program with each other, and to try to be married people. You know, that's kind of challenging at times. I never knew how to be married. I mean, so it's a wonderful experience, though, to go through life being a part of this fellowship and experiencing the miracles on a daily basis. I think we are so blessed that I've been around a long time. I've had some incredible things happen to me in my life. I've had wonderful experiences. But nothing, there is not even anything that is a close second to being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a wonderful church home that I belong to. I love my church, but I don't go to them and say, hi, I'm Debbie, I'm an alcoholic, and I need some help, you know. they're wonderful people. But and I do love them, and I feel a sense of family there. But it's just like I don't even go to my own family and go, "Hi, I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic," you know. So you all are my extended family, and I know that I can go to a meeting anywhere, and hopefully those big book studies are the majority now rather than the discussion groups, although, you know, if anybody wants to have a discussion, that's fine. That's just fine with me. But to study the book, I mean, I've been studying the book for over 18 years, and it becomes more mysterious, and absolutely I know that if the Bible is divinely inspired, that absolutely the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was divinely inspired. Because I think Bill and all of his, when he talks about his ego or his depression, you know, Bill couldn't have written a book all caught up in his ego and his depression, I don't believe, without the intervention of God. And I want to share one quick thing before I stop. Charlie and I were in Akron. Well, we went to Cleveland to see the Cleveland Indians play baseball this summer. We like to go to ballparks around the country in the summertime. But I looked on the map and I said, you know, Akron's really close. It's only like 44 miles from Cleveland. So on our way back to Tulsa, we stopped in Akron to see Dr. Bob's house. And it was just, gosh, I mean, it was incredible. And it's this little corner. How many of you have been to Akron to see Dr. Bob's house? Okay, about half a dozen people, so you know what it's like. And they bought the house next door where they had the archives, and they show you a film, and they've just produced a new film recently, and it's called House Full of Miracles. That's what it's called, House Full of Miracles. And so we sat down. It's a 30-minute video, and it's just a very well-done 30-minute telling about when Bill came, when Bill came to Akron and Sister Ignatia and the phone call at the Mayflower Hotel, and it's just beautiful. And we showed that at Miracle's 13th anniversary last month, and it was really, really, I mean, we saw it when we were in Akron, and we bought the tape, and we thought that would be a good thing to do for our group's anniversary party. And it was. If anybody wants to borrow it, we have a copy of it, or if you want any information, it's a beautiful, I don't think it would break any traditions about, you know, because I see this big screen of, let's utilize this big screen. And it's only 30 minutes long, but it's just beautiful. But, and that was really special, you know, to go in to see, and you kind of really can't feel. It's a small house. I mean, it's a two-story home, and the rooms are small. And it, upstairs, they go, well, this is where Bill stayed. And you're going, oh, this is where Bill stayed. I mean, it's just kind of bizarre, you know, that they put one of the kids probably down in the basement so that Bill could stay up in one of the bedrooms instead of putting Bill in the basement. Anyway, it was a beautiful AA experience, and we keep talking about maybe getting a whole busload of people and taking, because that's all we got to see, but there's Dr. Bob's, where they buried him, and Henrietta Seiberling's estate, and the Mayflower Hotel, and all these little places around Akron that you can visit on the little AA tour. But it is an incredible way to live. I'm so completely grateful to be sober today. I would have nothing. Life would not be worth living were it not for you people in the 12 steps of AA. And thank you, Bonnie, so much for having me here, and God bless you all. Thank you.